Welcome to the Science Podcast for October 5th, 2012. I'm Edward Hermy.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This week, more tools for battling depression, the mysteries of the brain, and new findings in the world of dinosaurs.
What we're seeing is just a much more complex tooth than anyone ever imagined in a reptile or in any animal for that matter.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
We all respond differently to stress and trauma. Genetics may be partially to blame for that diversity, but recent research suggests that we may have more influence over our emotional responses than we thought. In a review this week, Dennis Charney argues that resilience training may help us to bounce back from circumstances that could otherwise lead to depression. He spoke with me about resilience from his office in New York.
The work that we've done and others have identified, in our case, 10 factors that relate to resilience, the ability to bounce back from stress in one's life. And we found in that work that many of the factors that enhance resilience to stress could be helpful in treating patients with depression and anxiety disorders. And in fact, patients with depression seem to lack the kinds of attributes that resilient people have. So what we try to do in the article is point that out and raise new ideas on how we can enhance the treatment of depression by developing resilience in patients who are vulnerable to depression.
So what are the key factors, then, that you think contribute to resilience?
So I'll mention a couple. We've come up with 10. One is a positive attitude. Patients who are resilient are optimistic in a realistic way. They take a clear-eyed view of the challenges ahead of them and have the confidence that they will prevail.
Mm-hmm.
So optimism is strongly related to resilience. On the other hand, patients with depression frequently suffer from a pessimistic attitude, a negative bias in how they view their world. And in fact, a form of therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, can be very helpful in reversing that in patients with depression. Other factors that we have found that relate to resilience include identifying a resilient role model or even a set of role models to help guide you through tough times. And that can be very helpful for patients with depression, because frequently depressed patients can gain inspiration from meeting and learning from other individuals who have been depressed but have been able to recover and move on with their life.
Hmm.
Facing your fears is very important. Fear is normal and can serve as a guide, and facing your fear can increase your self-esteem.
Hmm.
You can learn and practice skills necessary to move through fears. I'll mention one more, and that is the importance of establishing and nurturing a supportive social network. Very few people can go through it alone. We all need a safety net during times of stress. You gain emotional strength from close relationships with people and even organizations. So that can help you be more resilient. And on the other hand, when you're depressed, a supportive social network can be very helpful.
So in other words, we're not necessarily at the mercy of whatever negative circumstances we may be exposed to, that if we actually develop some of these qualities of resilience, we may actually be able to better deal with them, even if they are rotten in and of themselves.
Exactly. You'd be surprised what you can overcome.
So do you propose the sort of resilience training, I guess one might say, do you propose this as a method of treatment or of prevention of depression?
Both. I think what we've learned about from resilient people and, you know, develop essentially a prescription, you know, for resilience has implications for everyone, because we are all going to face difficult challenges in our life. We all lose loved ones. We all at some point face medical illness. We all have unexpected stress in our life. So I think by developing essentially a toolbox of skills that will help you through the inevitable challenges in your life can help everyone, both from a prevention point of view and also, you know, overcoming your challenges. On the other hand, I think some of what we learn can be added to the armamentarium of treatment for certain psychiatric disorders like depression and serious forms of anxiety.
Hmm.
I think that could be incorporated into kind of the standard treatments that we currently use.
And do you have any examples of this sort of resilience really paying off?
There's an individual we profile in our book who is a young woman that I knew from when she was a baby, who was born with a congenital medical problem called spina bifida, which can give you difficulties in walking and certain bodily functions and growth. And she was optimistic from the day she was born. And that really helped her have the confidence, you know, not to give up on things. And ultimately, what she was able to do is become a swimmer that won gold medals in the Paralympics. She graduated valedictorian of her high school class, went to Yale, swam on the varsity swim team, not because she was a great swimmer, but because she was a role model, you know, for others. We asked her about role models herself, and she had many different role models, including, you know, believe it or not, FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who had a walk with canes to get around. She thought, you know, that was something she wanted to model. She never wanted to be in a wheelchair. So she's a great inspiration for other people and utilized a lot of the things that she helped us identify to become a more resilient person.
So by saying that you can develop these sorts of attitudes and seek out these sorts of social networks, this puts resilience from depression to a certain extent into the hands of the individual. Is this controversial at all within the field of psychology?
It doesn't put, you know, the treatment totally in the hands of the individual.
Not totally, right.
You know,
right.
But because if you have a serious form of depression, getting counseling from an experienced therapist or getting medicine from a physician that is well-versed in the use of antidepressant medicines is very important. However, you can take personal responsibility. You can help yourself as well. And I think the work that has led to a better understanding of resilience can help people recover from depression in conjunction with the kind of standard treatment that they currently get. You know, for example, establishing a nurturing, supportive social network is very important for people with depression. Very few can go it alone. We encourage our patients with depression, you know, to work in further developing a supportive social network of people that they can develop close relationships with. Emotional strength accrues from close relationships. We also found that attention to physical well-being is very important. Physical exercise has positive effects on hardiness, your mood. It improves your self-esteem. And in fact, there's even been some work that structured physical exercise can have antidepressant effects. So I think this work enables the person to work on things themselves in addition to kind of the standard treatment that they get.
Now, I think one thing that really strikes me is that this is not exactly a new idea, this notion of cultivating resilience. Why do you think it took so long for it to reach clinical medicine?
You know, I don't know. I think we sometimes, you know, have a lot to learn from others, and sometimes they're ahead of the curve with us, and I think this might be an example, but, you know, it's never too late.
Mm-hmm.
And the work on resilience is now being applied, you know, more and more. In our country, for example, the United States military has begun to invest like upwards of $100 million to use resilience work to train our soldiers to better able to handle the stresses that come with combat. So that's an example of kind of moving forward in a preventative way. There's also been a lot of work in children and adolescents to try to help them become more resilient, particularly if they're growing up in challenging environments. So I think we're just kind of, you know, in the beginning phases of making this relevant to patients and to, you know, more the general population, but it's a very exciting time.
Great. Well, Dennis Charney, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Dennis Charney writes about resilience as prevention and treatment of depression in a review this week, part of a special section on depression. You could find the whole section at www.sciencemag.org/special/depression.
In the world of teeth, one might not expect a whole lot of diversity. They chew, they grind, they look pretty, or sometimes not. But in animal lineages, many herbivores like horses and elephants have evolved complex teeth made up of multiple layers of abrasive material for grinding. Recently, researchers have found even more complex teeth in fossils of 85-million-year-old duck-billed dinosaurs, or hadrosaurs. Gregory Erickson chewed the fat with me about why this finding was so surprising.
The duck-billed dinosaurs were extremely diverse herbivores of the late Cretaceous. We call them the cows of the Cretaceous. They were really common. And they dominated Asia and North America and parts of Europe in the latest Cretaceous. They were plant-eating animals. They were gregarious, so they ran around in big herds. Sometimes we find fossil deposits with hundreds, sometimes even thousands of these animals that all died together. They had broad duck-like bills. They're four-legged animals, but they could pop up onto two legs if they wanted to browse out of a tree. But they also had big, broad beaks, which we think they used to graze with. Their teeth are really amazing. They have what we call dental batteries. They have up to 1,400 teeth in their dentitions.
Wow.
And yeah, it's amazing. These teeth were constantly erupting and moving across the chewing surface, and the teeth were sort of interlocked with one another. And on that chewing surface, those interlocked teeth would self-wear to create these very coarse file-like surfaces that they would titrate plants with.
Focusing on the teeth, what exactly were you hoping to understand with this paper?
Well, what I was trying to figure out was, how could these animals have teeth that could self-wear to create chewing surfaces that were very much like those of horses and bison? All kinds of crests and basins and ridges and all kinds of things for finely titrating plants. And the reason this was quite a mystery to me was that we tend to think of reptiles as having very simplistic tooth structure, just having an enamel outer shell and a soft dentine inner shell.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was looking at this, it didn't make any sense because horse and bison and elephant teeth are composed of four different tissue types. Each tissue type has a different wear attributes. And it seemed to me that there must be something going on here that we're missing. They must somehow be more complex. That basically started my analysis, trying to figure out what they were actually composed of, and then ultimately figuring out how they actually self-wore to create these grinding surfaces.
So you mentioned dental tissues, tissue types. What exactly are these?
Well, for instance, in human teeth, you have an enamel outer shell, and then we have dentine as the core of the tooth. What I found in these duck-billed dinosaur teeth is that they actually have six major tissues. They have enamel and dentine. It's called the orthodentine, which is the same type of dentine that we have in their teeth. But then they had four other tissues. They had these things called giant tubules, which are branches of the pulp cavity that were lined by a very wear-resistant tissue that kind of created ridges within the teeth. And then there was a layer of what we call mantle dentine, which is an extremely hard type of dentine that actually takes over the job of forming crests across the chewing surfaces in these animals' teeth. Then there was coronal cementum, which is a root attachment tissue. Humans have this too, but what this tissue's done is it's migrated up onto the chewing surface, and it helps support the crests in these animals. So these really hard tissues tend to be brittle, and this cementum is a supporting tissue to keep them from fracturing. What we're seeing is just a much more complex tooth than anyone ever imagined in a reptile or in any animal for that matter. It's actually more complex than what we see in horses and bison and elephants, which only have four tissues.
Horses and bison today have developed this grinding ability. Is this kind of convergent evolution, that this is the best way to go about eating these types of plants?
The way that animals feed on very tough and often abrasive foodstuffs, in the case of horses, for instance, when they're eating grasses and these sorts of things, to pulverize them with a grinding surface, file-like surface. And this allows them to break open the cell walls on these plants and get nutrients from them. And this is independently evolved in different kinds of mammals. We see it in the horses, and we've seen it in lots of the bovids, such as the bison. We see it in elephants as well, also in rodents. And we also see it now in these hadrosaur dinosaurs. So it's clearly a case of convergence, a remarkable convergence at that.
So what were your methods for actually understanding these teeth? How did you go about studying them?
Figuring out this mystery, it took a long time and a lot of steps. The first step was just trying to figure out what the teeth were made of. And so what I did was I took some of these dinosaur teeth and I made microscope slides of them and described the tissues that I saw. And as soon as I prepared the first sections, I realized that this was a much more complex tooth than anyone had ever imagined. It certainly wasn't a two-tissue complex that was our old model for these teeth. Actually, if you look at a hadrosaur tooth, it looks like an atlas for a dental school. It's got all kinds of tissues and all in one slide. It's pretty amazing. And so anyway, the first thing I did was just figured out what tissues were there, and then I looked at their distributions and tried to correlate the distributions of those tissues with attributes we see on the chewing surfaces of the duck-billed dinosaur teeth. In other words, at some parts of the teeth, they're able to make crests, and other sections make deep basins and these sorts of things. So I was trying to correlate where the tissues were relative to these chewing surfaces.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next step was trying to figure out, how did this complex of tissues self-wear to allow for this grinding surface. So The first thing I did to figure out the mechanics of this was indented some of the teeth with a nano indenter. And I found that there were differences in their material properties, which suggests not only that there were differences between the tissues, but the thing that was exciting about that is, you know, here we are looking at 70 million year old teeth, and they seem to preserve actual biomechanical signature.
Yeah, that actually seems pretty incredible. So they're the same characteristics of the teeth are still present. They haven't been replaced by rock or stone that we would think of when bones are fossilized.
Yeah, exactly. Basically, what we're saying is that some of that mechanical signal is still there. And the most important property right off the bat was hardness, which is basically how the material resists deformation when you push a diamond indenter down into it. How much of a mark does it leave, essentially? And what I found was that the relative hardnesses seemed to be still preserved there. So to confirm that, I teamed up with Greg Sawyer's lab down at the University of Florida. He runs arguably the world's most sophisticated tribology lab, or people that study wear, essentially, is what they are.
Okay.
And I teamed up with them and showed them what I had. And so they did a much more sophisticated analysis of the hardnesses throughout the teeth. And then they did wear testing, where they would actually run a simulated scratch testing back and forth across the teeth, which mimics the abrasion from the abrasives in the plants of these animals. And from that, they were able to quantify what the hardnesses were and the wear rates for the tissues in these teeth. And then they took it one step further, which was just amazing, is that they've developed three-dimensional wear models, and they built models of the tissue distribution, computer renderings of duck-billed dinosaur tooth batteries, and mm-hmm. then they ran a theoretical abrasive-compliant pad across it and let it self-wear to whatever it would do with those various properties that they discovered for those tissues. And when they ran this, it would wear right back to the natural worn morphology we saw in the real batteries, which shows that really strong confirmation that the material properties really were preserved, and furthermore, that we could actually understand how each tissue contributed to the different structures we see on the chewing surfaces.
Yeah. So these teeth are actually different from our own in that when they wear down, it exposes a different part of the tooth that's then fresh to be worn?
Yeah, exactly. What happened with these teeth is they would erupt, and as they hit the chewing surface, they would start being used in grinding, and they'd start wearing down. And as they'd wear down, the suite or ensemble of tissues in the duck-billed dinosaur teeth would become exposed. And because of the distributions of these tissues and in each tooth, they would start self-wearing to create crests and basins and whatnot, and then they'd move along across the chewing surface as another tooth would erupt, and so on a chewing surface there would be hundreds of these teeth exposed at the same time. These complexes of self-wearing teeth would create all the file-like or rasp-like surfaces that were required for grinding. So it's really a self-wearing system. It's really remarkable that nature was able to come up with something like this. It's really a mechanical marvel. You know, even in industry now, they're still trying to replicate these sorts of things. But the dinosaurs had this figured out, you know, 70 million years ago.
So you've talked about the complexities and diversities of these teeth. Did this sort of impact the evolution of the family of these duck-billed dinosaurs?
When the hadrosaurid battery first evolved, these animals basically went through an explosive adaptive radiation. All kinds of different species showed up, and they radiated throughout the northern hemisphere. It appears that this was probably a key innovation that really sprung them. What's interesting is that the first forms that evolved had a dual slicing and grinding dentition, but later ones actually would go to different morphologies. Some would evolve pure grinding surfaces. Others would go to pure shearing surfaces. So what we see in their evolution is that they were radiating into different ecological niches. And we've gone back and looked at some of those more derived or more evolved tooth batteries. And what we're finding is that in the case of the slicers, they have tissues that accentuate wear resistance that allows them to create a slicing face. And the ones that have pure grinding dentitions have lost the tissues, allowed for creating of slicing faces. So basically what this says is that modifications in the appearances of these tissues is really what's driving the changes in morphology. And of course, allowed them to feed upon different types of plants and occupy different ecological niches.
Well, Greg Erickson, thanks for talking with me.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Gregory Erickson and colleagues discussed the complex teeth of duck-billed dinosaurs in a report this week.
Levels of mood disorder diagnoses seem to be holding steady. But in an editorial this week, Hans-Ulrich Witschen argues that the burden of these diseases is on the rise. Science's Meghna Sachdev spoke with Witschen about why this might be.
the complexity of our life in today's societies has tremendously increased, which means even minor disturbances in mental health can have dramatic influences.
Hans-Ulrich Witschen writes about the burden of mood disorders in an editorial this week. To hear the whole interview, find his article online in Science's October 5th issue.
Why do we sleep? Why do we dream? How can we hold on to memories for decades? Our brains are mystery machines, and this week's News Focus section is dedicated to a discussion of neurological conundrums. Science's Sarah Crespi spoke with Greg Miller about some of what we don't know about the brain, starting with how our brains make us different, not just from other animals, but also from each other.
Our tendencies and preferences in life, the way we behave, the things we do, the things we're good at, the things we're bad at, that's fascinating. And that's, runs through literature and trashy TV shows and office gossip. So we know that some of it has to come down to our genes and some of it has to come down to our life experience. But the really interesting question is what happens in the brain when those two streams meet and how it is that our genes and our experience kind of interact to shape the brain.
So I think you make a very interesting point in your article about how a lot of brain research involves averaging across multiple people just to kind of get an understanding of how things work. But in cases where you're looking at individual differences, you have to look at many, many brains to see what differences actually make a difference.
Yeah, that's true. And so that makes those experiments kind of harder to do and more expensive to do, which is why a lot of research in cognitive neuroscience, where you're paying for very expensive time and an fMRI scanner, has tended to average people together. But when people have looked for individual differences in the brain, either in the anatomy of the brain or the function of the brain, they find differences and interesting differences that correlate with differences in perception and memory, even intelligence. One of the most systematic efforts to look at this is just getting underway. It's a study called the Human Connectome Project, which is going to look at 1,200 people, putting them in scanners and doing a whole bunch of different types of brain scans to look at their brain anatomy and how different regions of the brain are connected with each other and how activity in different parts of the brain might differ from one individual to the next. So that'll be really one of the biggest and most systematic efforts so far to look specifically for how individuals vary in their brain anatomy and brain function. And right now we don't even have a good sense of that, just how much variation is out there, let alone how it accounts for things like our differences in cognition and personality and things like that.
So the next mystery that we're going to talk about is something else that maybe distinguishes us. It's our memories. What are some of the outstanding questions in this area of research?
Memory is just a whole bunch of puzzles wrapped up into one. At one level, it's just amazing when you think about the fact that all of our experiences in life, everything we see and do, the people we know, is somehow recorded in the gelatinous tissue of the brain.
Right.
And that's just kind of amazing. And not only that, it persists for decades, even while all the cells, the neurons that, must be representing those memories are sort of undergoing this continuous process of molecular recycling. Our memories persist for the most part. And so the final mystery and the one that we chose to tackle here is how we get the memories back out. How is it that we can, with just a little bit of prompting and usually in a fraction of a second, pull up the memory that we're looking for?
So in your article, you kind of walk through the basic understanding of memory storage. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So one of the key ideas that pertains to retrieval is the idea that any given memory you can think of for a person, place, thing, or an event is probably stored in the brain in a fairly small number of neurons that are scattered throughout the brain. So there'll be a neuron over here that represents the music that was playing at the party, and a neuron over here will say something about the memory of the food you had, and so on. To call up any particular memory is going to require reactivating all these neurons that are scattered across the brain in different areas and reactivating just the right subset of neurons that corresponds to the memory you're looking for. And that, on the face of it, is kind of an impossible seeming task. How could your brain, at a moment's notice, call up just the right neurons that it needs to recreate that memory in your brain?
So how are researchers trying to figure this out? What kind of methods are they using?
There are kind of two parallel streams of research that aren't quite coming together just yet. One of them is in rodents, where people can do more invasive experiments to actually look at the electrical activity of individual neurons. Mm-hmm. And in that area, a lot of the work has focused on the hippocampus, which is a part of the brain that we know is really important for memory and navigation. And people there are recording these sequences of neural activity in the hippocampus that are very similar. When an animal runs through a maze, its hippocampal neurons will play out in a very specific sequence. And then when the animal takes a break and is just sitting around doing nothing or maybe running on a wheel, it replays some sequences that are very similar to that. And it looks like that replay, people think, might be actually the rat's brain in the act of recalling its path through the maze, or maybe reminding itself what path it needs to take the next time.
But can they predict from what the rat is thinking, I guess, what it's going to do?
Well, they can, yeah, of course, they would love to know what the rat is actually thinking, but unfortunately that's
right.
Beyond the tools of science. But they can predict what it'll do next, and that's really interesting, and part of the reason that people think that what these sequences represent really does have something to do with memory and planning. And it actually kind of suggests that remembering and planning are very closely related processes, maybe even two sides of the same coin.
And so this is in rats. Are researchers seeing similar things in people? Is this the kind of study that you can do with humans?
Yeah, well, fortunately not. It's kind of invasive. But yeah, that's the other stream, is the work that's being done in humans. And in some really rare cases, it is actually possible to record the activity of neurons in the hippocampus of humans. But it's only done for special cases, when surgeons are monitoring brain activity in preparation for surgery, usually for people with intractable epilepsy. In the course of those recordings, in some cases, neuroscientists have been able to sort of tag along and record some of the data in a way that doesn't interfere with the care for the patients. And so that's as close as we get to the kind of experiments that people have been doing in rats. But there's a body of research that uses fMRI and other brain scanning methods to look at how memories are encoded and retrieved in the human brain. And there's interesting findings too. They're actually at the point now where researchers can predict in a kind of contrived experiment which of several memories a person in a brain scanner is recalling, just based on the pattern of brain activity that's elicited while the person is recalling a particular memory.
Interesting. So for the last mystery, we're going to discuss, why is mental illness so tough to treat? You bring up some historical factors in your article that have led us to where we are now in regards to treatment. So besides our historical progression, what are the other barriers that you're seeing out there to formulating effective treatments?
Part of it is just the really obvious fact that the brain is the most complicated organ in the body, and it's hard to study. You know, these are disorders that attack the human mind, and that's really hard to model in other animals. And that's obviously the source of so much research, and so many of the breakthroughs in biomedical science have come from modeling disorders in animals. And that seems to be harder to do for psychiatric disorders than it may be for something like cancer.
So there is some progress being made in this arena, though. Can you talk about that?
Sure. There are a number of encouraging signs, and they come from a lot of different areas. One of them comes from recent work with fast-acting antidepressant drugs. The current drugs that we have for depression take 6 to 8 weeks to really kick in and show a benefit. And for someone who's really in the grips of major depression and maybe having suicidal thoughts, that's an awfully, awfully long time. So people would love to get some faster-acting antidepressant drugs. And there's some progress recently on that front, including a drug called ketamine that interferes with receptors for glutamate, which is a neurotransmitter in the brain.
You also bring up the idea of changing the way these diseases are diagnosed or understood, and that might actually facilitate research.
Yeah, there's been a lot of discussion about that in recent years, partly because of the controversy around the new edition of the Diagnostic Manual, the DSM. Five that's undergoing revision right now and will be out next year. The way psychiatric disorders have been diagnosed for decades, well, forever really, is to do with the, you know, outward signs of people's behavior and their subjective reports, like what they say they're experiencing, the kind of anguish that they describe in their own minds. So there's some thinking that that doesn't really carve nature at its joints, that these are disorders that involve dysfunction in the brain, and if we could better understand the circuitry in the brain that goes wrong and understand the mechanisms of these disorders better, we'd be in a better position to develop new treatments that really work much better than the ones we have now.
All right. Well, Greg Miller, thanks for talking with me.
My pleasure.
Greg Miller is a staff writer for Science. He writes about mysteries of the brain and a special news focus this week. For more mysteries, visit www.sciencemag.org/special/neuro2012.
Finally today, I'm here with online news editor David Grimm, who's here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our online daily news site. So Dave, in our first story, we've got an unexpected astronomical companionship.
That's right, Carrie. Well, black holes, as most of us know, are pretty violent things. They're these, you know, giant monsters out there in the universe that swallow stars and gas and a whole bunch of other stuff. And they're also thought to be pretty antisocial, the idea being that you couldn't have two black holes in the same cluster of stars, that they'd be so violent and aggressive that they would essentially kick each other out, or one would kick the other one out. And that's why this new study is so surprising. Astronomers say they actually found two black holes in the same cluster of stars.
So what's the evidence of this unexpected finding?
Well, basically what astronomers did is they took some observations with what's called the Very Large Array, which is located in Socorro, New Mexico. And these observations revealed two objects whose radio spectra resemble those of black hole systems. And they were able to take the spectra, identify these couple of black holes. Now, what was interesting is the team of astronomers that detected them didn't actually see any X-rays coming from the systems, which is usually a marker of black holes. But for some experts, that's actually sort of a knock against the finding, because they say they probably should be X-rays, and maybe these aren't black holes. Maybe these are other objects that are sort of giving off similar emissions, but actually aren't black holes.
Right. I would imagine that if this is an unexpected finding and the evidence doesn't 100% point to them being black holes, you know, I imagine there must be some other possible explanations.
Exactly. The expert in the story says that, you know, it could just be a star, but the astronomers that made the discovery are pretty sure they've got black holes. And what they say is actually based on some of the observations that they're making, that it actually could be actually more than two black holes in this cluster. There actually could be a whole bunch of them there, which would really sort of contradict this theory that black holes can't exist together within these clusters, and may force astronomers just to revise their ideas about just how antisocial black holes are.
Right. And so if this actually turns out to be true, it could be a very big deal.
Exactly.
Well, all right. And our second story begins with an experiment with a hermit crab and a toy octopus.
Right. This is actually a really fun one. A marine biologist stuck a toy octopus in a tank of water and tried to scare a hermit crab. And you actually can see a video of this happening on the site. So the question is, why are they trying to scare these poor little hermit crabs with toy octopi? And the answer has to do with ocean acidity. And one of the big concerns with climate change is that, you know, we're pumping so much carbon dioxide into the air with our burning of fossil fuels and other human activities, and the ocean actually absorbs a lot of this carbon dioxide. Now, that's kind of a good thing, because it means that the Earth is warming slower than it would otherwise, because the ocean's absorbing the carbon dioxide rather than the atmosphere, which would trap heat. But the problem is that as the ocean absorbs carbon dioxide, it becomes more acidic. And in fact, studies have found that there's been a 30% increase in the surface waters of the ocean in the last few years, which is really troubling. And the reason it's troubling is because there's a lot of creatures that live in the water that depend on a very balanced pH. And as the ocean becomes more acidic, this pH decreases. And one concern is it could corrode the shells of creatures like clams, crabs, and shrimp.
And hermit crabs.
Exactly, like hermit crabs. And another concern is that it could actually change the behavior of some marine organisms, maybe by disrupting their brain development. And so that all gets back to, well, why are we trying to scare a hermit crab with an octopus? And the question is, you know, if hermit crabs live in more acidic waters, are they going to become less attuned to their predators? An octopi are one of the big predators of hermit crabs.
Oh, so this was not so much an experiment about the effects of acidification on shells, but about the actual, you know, personalities, so to speak, of the creatures affected.
Right. The question was, you know, can acidification not just affect the shells, but actually also affect the personality and affect it in bad ways? Basically, what they did is they vacuumed up a bunch of hermit crabs from about 900 meters down using a robotic submarine. This was off the coast of California, and they brought the crabs back to the lab, and they put them in two separate tanks. Some of them lived in tanks filled with seawater with a pH of about 7.6, and that's pretty typical of what the crabs experience in their deep-sea home. In the other tank, they made the waters much more acidic. The pH was about 7.1, and this would be like the acidity of the ocean water sometime in the future if the oceans keep on absorbing CO2 at their present rate.
Mm.
And what they found was that the crabs that lived in the more acidic water tended to flick their antennae less often, and they were slower to sniff out food, which indicates some changes in their behavior, which might be sort of detrimental both to their ability to find food, but also potentially to their ability to notice predators. That being said, what they found was both groups of hermit crabs responded very similarly to the octopus. Both of them fled into their shells at sort of the same frequency. So at least according to this study, there isn't actually a big difference in how hermit crabs are avoiding predators, regardless of the acidity of the water.
Well, even so, even if the behaviors of these hermit crabs aren't actually being affected, I mean, their shells are still going to become more difficult to grow, right?
Exactly. Well, you know, a lot of the shells they rely on could actually start dissolving if the water gets too acidic. And one of the researchers joked at the meeting, this was actually presented at a marine science meeting last week, that instead of Habitat for Humanity, we might need Habitat for Hermanity for these crabs if conditions get so bad. So it's still a big warning sign for the future.
Certainly. And on to our third story now, where we're talking about the longevity of primates.
Right. And this story actually also has to do a little bit with personality. Now we're moving on to primates and whether personality is a big factor in longevity. And stated succinctly, do nice primates live longer? A study was carried out with a group of wild baboons at a reserve in Botswana. And these baboons have been observed for almost 20 years. So scientists have a lot of data on their behaviors, their personalities. And some previous research has suggested that females live longer when they have close, long-lasting relationships with other females. And that's sort of characterized by them spending more time together and grooming each other. And the question in this study is that linked to sort of what we would call niceness?
Hmm.
Do females that live longer and have these closer, long-lasting relationships, are they actually what we would call nicer to each other as human beings? And as you can imagine, that's a pretty tricky thing
right.
to suss out. You know, we have a pretty good gauge of whether human beings are nice to each other, but how do you really determine whether other animals are being nice to each other?
Right. Well, and so how do we determine if they're being nice to one another?
Well, the researchers they looked at a few key behaviors. These included how often the females were alone, how often they touched other females, and how often they behaved aggressively, how often they were approached by others. And one interesting one was how often they grunted when approaching other females.
Hmm.
And grunting is actually a sign of goodwill. It's actually sort of like, hey, I like you, you know, something like that.
Hey, what's up?
Exactly. So it's not an aggressive move. And what the researchers found is that the females that scored highly on these measures of what they were calling niceness also tended to be friendly to all other females. So there was this connection between females that were sort of close to each other and also sort of exhibited these nice behaviors. And what all this means is, you know, sort of taking this all together, since we already know that females that spend more time together and sort of have these tighter bonds with other females live longer, and now correlating niceness with this, it all suggests that nicer primates tend to also live longer.
Well, now, this is only in reference to female primates. Is that right? I mean, there have been a lot of other studies showing, you know, the other important factors in males' lives.
That's right, because with males, it doesn't seem like niceness is really the criterion for whether males live longer. In fact, it tends to be their status, their rank on the social totem pole. In fact, alpha male baboons, the ones at the top of the totem pole tend to live longer mm-hmm. than males that rank lower. So with females, niceness seems to be key. With males, dominance seems to be key.
Hmm. And so I wonder how much this may reflect back on human societies.
Well, that's, of course, what everybody wants to know. You know, how much does this relate to us? And that is going to have to be determined by future studies.
Right. All right. And what else have we had on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Carrie, for Science Now, we've got a story about a new fanged dinosaur, and that's got a pretty neat picture with it, which I encourage everybody to check out on the site. Also, an update on the Curiosity rover on Mars, just what is Curiosity picking up and finding out about the red planet that we didn't know before. For Science Insider, we've got a story about the current state of Russian science, what's going on in Russia. Also, a story about what causes more scientific retractions. Is it misconduct or is it mistakes? And finally, for Science Live, this week's Science Live is about turning warring societies more peaceful. How can we turn pitchforks into plowshares? And next week's Science Live is about new therapies for mental illness. And that Science Live is going to be at a special time, 3 o'clock, Wednesday on October 10th. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Great. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Carrie.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out all of our news at news.sciencemag.org, including daily stories from Science Now and science policy from Science Insider. While you're there, be sure to check out Science Live, a live chat on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time, but next week on Wednesday.
And that concludes the October 5th, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Edward Hermy.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.